Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a national trend towards artistic censorship arrives here in the Valley, and how to make the hardest stories from history relatable. But first, the Trump administration has moved aggressively to block migrants from claiming asylum here in the United States. The changes have led to major disruptions in life at the border, in particular at shelters, which have long provided temporary housing and childcare and other assistance to families fleeing violence. KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky recently visited one of these shelters in Nogales, Sonora, and she joins me now to tell us about what she saw. Nina, good morning.
Hey, Sam, good morning.
So, Nina, tell us about this shelter that you visited and the folks you met there.
Yeah, so I visited a couple shelters in Nogales on this trip, but I kind of want to focus on this one because there are lots of really, kind of powerful stories at this shelter right now. The day that I went, there was a graduation happening at the shelter, which, sounds sort of odd and maybe joyful considering the circumstances. But this is a shelter really geared toward families. It has its own school. All these kids are moving up in a grade. And so the families were gathered to celebrate that. But it was a little bit different this year than it usually is at the shelter graduation. There were only about 20 kids, moving up a grade. Usually there are, more than 90 kids, or last year there were more than 90 kids enrolled in this school. But, when Trump came into office, as you said, he shut the door for asylum seekers and many of the families who are waiting in the shelter in Nogales, Sonora, to cross into Nogales, Arizona and into the U.S. Had their appointments canceled and are trying to figure out other options. So there are still some people waiting at the shelter because they have no other options, but it's a much smaller number than it has been in the past.
So, Nina, give us a sense of, prior to these changes that the Trump administration has been trying to make, what would the quote-unquote normal experience for a family at this shelter have been?
Yeah. So, this shelter has the capacity to hold up to, 300, 400 people. But right now there's only about somewhere around 45, 50 at the shelter.
Wow.
So it's much smaller numbers. Most of these folks are traveling with families. This shelter has a lot of social services and is really geared towards women, children, and families. And they have lots of programs to help people with their weight and connect them with legal services. In the last 6 months, many of these families have left. And so that means that the folks who are left behind really don't have many options. Most of them really, really can't go back to where they're coming from, whether that's a state in Mexico with a lot of violence, or somewhere in Central America where they're fleeing gang violence or threats. I talked to one of the students who was graduating on the day that I visited the shelter. She's 15. She loves school. She wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. And, she has just seen over the past 6 months her friends, the kids her age, leave the shelter. And now there's only about four kids left in her grade. But her family doesn't really have an option. They don't really have anywhere else to go. So they're just still here at the shelter.
So for the families that are leaving the shelter, as you were alluding to, typically in the past, they would have moved on to the U.S. side of the border and on into the United States. They're clearly still leaving the shelter. Where are they going now?
Yeah, so different places. But, a researcher that I talked to in Nogales, Sonora suspects that a lot of them are staying in Nogales, Sonora. They're just staying in these border communities and leaving shelters and sort of trying to integrate into the population near the border. Getting apartments and trying to find work in these border towns like Nogales, Sonora. And then, maybe at some point when policy changes in the US, they'll be able to cross. You know, other folks are going to other parts of Mexico. And, you know, some are whose original plan was to seek asylum in the US. If they're from a third country like El Salvador, Nicaragua, some are now looking to seek asylum in Mexico. I talked to one family at the shelter, a couple at the shelter that I visited, who I'd talked to in March. And in March, their plan was to wait until policy changed in the U.S. and they could seek asylum. But when I talked to them this time, they'd pretty much given up on that. Their plan now is to try to seek asylum in Mexico, which really changes the trajectory of you know, their life path. Because once you've seeked asylum in one country, you can't really seek asylum in a second country. So their plan now is to try to stay in Mexico.
Last question for you here, Nina. We have just about 30 seconds left. I wonder if I could ask you to characterize the emotional tenor of your visit. Was it optimistic? Was it anxious? What, in your perception, what did it feel like there?
Yeah, I mean, the word that really kept coming up, Sam, was desperation. Like, there really is this feeling of desperation. If the families who are still at these shelters, as I said, it means that they don't have another option, and they don't have another good option. So they're really, you know, afraid. They've been afraid since they left the places that they were fleeing, and they continue to be afraid. They don't know what life, what the next chapter is going to look like. And they're sort of have been in this limbo state for many months. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't feel there like things are going to get better at any point soon. So yeah, I think people are feeling really desperate. And like you said, anxious.
All right. Well, thank you for that portrait, Nina. That is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky.
Thanks, Sam.
The VA plans to reduce its workforce by 30,000 employees nationwide. It's a step back from the 76,000 they were projected to cut earlier this year. But while the agency says the reduction in force won't disrupt care and benefits for veterans, many outside the agency aren't convinced. David Lucier is one of those skeptics. He served in the U.S. Army Special Forces and established a nonprofit called the Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance. He told me he fears this is another step toward a larger goal of privatizing the VA, and that it comes at the worst time, especially for the Phoenix facility.
The VA has historically been understaffed, and so now we're going to cut staff and expect things to get better? I think not.
So let's talk about the understaffing and some of the chronic problems that have existed. I mean, you have been speaking out about the progress that the Phoenix VA has made, in your opinion, in the last decade since it was in the midst of a big scandal 10, 12 years ago. How far has the Phoenix VA come?
Well, the Phoenix VA has gone from rock bottom to top of the heap. They are one of the leading medical centers in the system, but they also stand up very, very well and exceed, actually, a lot of the medical centers or medical resources here in the Valley. And so this is exactly the opposite of what the VA medical needs at this time.
When you talk about understaffing and how the VA is currently understaffed, what does that look like? What are the impacts on care? Like, you go to the VA, right? You receive care there.
Yes. Yes, I do. Well, it just makes absolute sense. It means probably longer wait times, canceled appointments, you know, especially as we lose doctors, nurses, and frontline staff, fewer crisis responders, and mental health resources, including reduced capacity at the Veterans Crisis Line, and closure of detox and, you know, inpatient mental health beds.
So you're concerned about these cuts impacting so many areas of care, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And again, I'm a user. I've been there for 10 or 12 years, and I know what bad models look like, and this is a formula for disaster.
So let me ask you about what you're hearing from other veterans, from staff at the VA here in Phoenix as well. Are people equally concerned?
Ever since I got involved with the VA, one of the things I always ask when I go there is, how's it going? How are you feeling? How long you been with the VA? What changes have you seen? And right now, a lot of the staff that I've talked to over the past couple of months, they're unsteady. They're shaken over what they see is coming down the pike. And so they're worried. They're concerned. They're concerned about not only the care that they're able to give, but whether they're going to even have jobs in the next few weeks. So that's a huge distraction from giving patients the best care they can. And as far as the veterans community is concerned, I'm hearing the exact same thing that I'm relaying to you, and that is a lot of concern. We've been to the place, that dark place where we've got under resources, bad management, and the like. And the impact on veterans care is hugely negative. And right now, we've come to a place where we get great care at the VA, but we've also been to a place historically, and we've experienced the dark side of care, if you will, given by the VA. And we don't want to go back to that place. We want to continue forward because we've been there and done that. And now we're seeing these clouds on the horizon, and it's not a pretty sight.
So walk me through the implications as you began to before. I mean, like if a veteran like you can't get an appointment for something that they need to get an appointment for relatively soon, right? Like what happens? You got to go elsewhere to find that care?
In some cases, there's an alternative to go into the what they call community care, and I've on occasion used that element, and that system works really, really well on a limited basis. But here's my fear. My fear is that at the base rationale to reduce and cut the VA budget has been a year-long effort. Year-long efforts by Republicans to push the VA towards privatization. And they do that by weakening the VA from within. There's an understaffing and forcing people into the community care. And I might add, it's substantially higher price, higher cost to the system. So now, on occasion, for instance, I know that during the winter months, appointments at our Phoenix VA increases about 20%. Reason being is we get a lot of winter visitors come here, and a lot of them are veterans, and they seek care. And so in those kind of cases, maybe going to the community care might be a good answer, but it's not the answer. It should be a small element within the total solution.
Right, so you're concerned about efforts to privatize the VA. The current VA secretary, Doug Collins, said at his confirmation hearing that he's against privatization. He didn't push for that. Are you still concerned that that's the direction this administration is taking the VA in?
Absolutely. They know the reaction to privatization. They've been there and done that. In fact, Doug Collins was part of that movement back in the day. And I say back in the day when the Phoenix VA was going through its turmoil. And their answer was to privatize the VA. And I see not, the words may change, but the behavior's exactly the same. It's not just me. I talk with our elected officials. Senator Mark Kelly, continues to warn that these cuts will mean longer wait times for veterans in crisis, fewer healthcare providers, delays in veterans' access to benefits they've earned. A lot of veterans work at the VA. They know they're serving veterans. If I walk into a place, nobody ever asks me if I've ever been treated for PTS, if I've ever been treated for lymphoma, Do you have any metal in your body from bullets or shrapnel? None of those questions. But you go to the VA and it's assumed that you have experienced trauma and various medical conditions based on your service.
It's care coming from a different and maybe more informed perspective, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is David Lucier, President and CEO of the Arizona Veterans and Military Leadership Alliance, joining us to talk more about these cuts to the VA. David, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
We reached out to the Phoenix VA for comment on this story and did not receive a response by our deadline. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, can reading ancient stories help us cope with complicated modern emotions? But first, generally speaking, our brains are wired to avoid revisiting troubling memories, both personal and societal. It's a survival mechanism. But when it comes to things like racism, genocide, and oppression, it can also inhibit cultural progress. This complex dilemma was referred to by the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur as happy forgetting, which is now the title of an audio documentary that aims to explore this delicate relationship between past and future. The documentary is hosted and produced by Arizona journalist Ruxandra Guidi. Each episode is built around the experience of someone with a personal connection to some of the most harrowing moments in American history, from the systematic murder of Osage tribal members in Oklahoma to Chicago's turbulent history of racial injustice. I spoke to Guidi recently about the origins of the project, which grew out of her experience immigrating to the U.S. from Venezuela as a teenager.
So I moved to the U.S. in 1990 as a 14-year-old. And through my whole high school career, I never remember hearing about racial justice, about race, about slavery, about indigenous genocide. These are major, you know, episodes in American history that somehow keep repeating themselves. And yet I never heard mention of these things at my public high school in New Jersey. But I also think, you know, I don't think this, I know this, America as a society never went through a process of truth and reconciliation. There's a lot of unsolved conversations, unsolved issues, episodes in history. And as someone who arrived here at such an impressionable age, that really made an impact on me and really drew me towards wanting to report on justice issues. But at this point in my career, you know, 20 plus years in, I realized, you know, these are the reasons why we don't talk about these things. And I want to get more into that. And so that's what I did with Happy Forgetting.
Okay. Okay. Since you came here when you were 14, I would imagine you have some memories of your schooling in Venezuela. Was there a difference in terms of the way that history was talked about when you were going to school there?
You know, it was very similar. I mean, in Venezuela and much of Latin America, history as we know it, right, with capital H, starts with the colonial period, starts with conquest, really. And, you know, when I went to school at this point, I'm talking elementary school, middle school in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, these were the narratives also. So in many ways, it was not all that different. The thing that was different in Venezuela in those years was that we really believed we were a post-racial society in the sense that we have people of all ethnic and cultural backgrounds living in the city. They have the same opportunities for work, for housing, or at least that was the narrative. That's what we all discussed. And it wasn't really questioned. So I think, you know, what we experienced here in America, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, although it's been going for longer, but this desire to really look deeper into the past, to question the record, to revise history or to think more about who's telling the story, is something that is happening elsewhere as well. But in my childhood, you know, in the 80s, in Venezuela, we didn't really question these things either.
Yeah. Well, so going back to this idea that we choose the frame through which we look at history, or we have the opportunity to do that, perhaps I should say. One of the things that is really engaging about the essayists that you feature in each of these episodes is that, to my ear at least, we have this experience of hearing them first become aware of the limitations of the frame that they had maybe previously relied upon for in their understanding of history, and then choosing a new frame.
Kim Fox was born here in Chicago. She grew up in Cabrini Green, which is like notorious for being one of the roughest public housing complexes in the country. 95% of America's state's attorneys are white. So for a black woman from such an over-policed yet underprotected place to become the top law enforcement officer in the land, it's a big thing.
Right. The moment that you ask the question, how is it that a girl from a single parent, a teenage mother like many that we know, who was abused, who was homeless, who was poor, how did she make it? When you ask yourself that question, you know it is based upon the supposition that I was supposed to fail.
How did you find these speakers? What were you looking for in that process?
I have to be honest, Ed, that this project first started with me thinking that I would tell all the stories. The more I started to talk to people, we really wanted to explore, when we talk about racial history, whom do we celebrate? Whose stories do we bury? Mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. stories do we tell over and over again? I wanted to explore this idea of hopelessness as an enemy of justice. And our instinct to sometimes abandon where we're from or where we came from, and what it takes to work towards racial justice today. What would it take to achieve a broader societal transformation when it comes to racial justice? And so the more I started realizing, okay, these are the big questions that little old me wants to take on in this podcast. Like, who am I to tell all these stories? And at that point, it became clear to me that I really wanted to invite others to tell those stories and to challenge me on how to tell those stories. I went straight to the people whose work I'd heard before. You know, I am an audio person. I come from public radio. I've been doing this for almost 25 years. So I've had the luxury of meeting a lot of really talented storytellers uh-huh. from around the country.
Right.
And some whom I haven't met, but I've heard. And I decided I really need to chat with them and ask them what they would like to explore, how they would like to do it. And so that is why we ended up with an anthology and why each story is radically different from the next. Some of them are more like audio documentaries, uh-huh. you know, with scenes and sense of place and characters. And others are really very personal, and many of them are essays.
Well, as a last question for you, Ruxandra, I wonder, you know, you came into this project from a place, it sounds like, of this surprise early in your life mm-hmm. about the lack of a certain kind of framing, the lack of a certain kind of awareness in the way that history was delivered to you. I know that you have now completed at least one season of Happy Forgetting, and there are these six episodes, and it's a real emotional journey moving through the series. Was there anything about engaging with historical memory in this different way that surprised you?
Oh, gosh, so much. I mean, I would say the biggest thing is that, you know, things don't happen in isolation. Leadership, when it comes to people working towards justice, don't work in isolation. We have a tendency to think, you know, in America at least, we think, let's say, for example, about Rosa Parks, you know, and the bus boycott. And we single out Rosa Parks. We don't think about the movements that gave birth to someone like Rosa Parks, to all the people before her who did not get the credit in the story, who mobilized in ways and who were attacked and very much faced a lot of repression for doing the same things that Rosa Parks did. So I think the biggest lesson for me, and I hope this is something that comes across in the podcast, is that nobody acts in isolation, but giving myself and others the freedom to kind of tell these stories in a more honest way, to have them be more personal, to have them question and probe this historical record really gave me this like newfound confidence in the work that we do and in the ways that we can shape public opinion.
Well, Ruxandra Guidi is a Tucson-based reporter, journalist, and is the host and producer of the podcast series Happy Forgetting. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam. It was a pleasure.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. The recently approved new state budget does not include any additional money to add to the staff overseeing Arizona's school voucher program. And the person in charge of that program, John Ward, says he expects spending on the Empowerment Scholarship Account, or ESA program, to reach $1 billion next school year. My co-host Mark Brody spoke about this with Wayne Shutsky of KJZZ's Politics Desk.
Wayne, let's start with John Ward and what he had to say to lawmakers this week. It sounds like his message is basically, we are trying to catch as many of these expenses, as many of these purchases as shouldn't go through as possible, but we can't really do it all with the resources we have. Is that fair?
He didn't quite go that far, but he did give the impression that, you know, we have these 12 people essentially who are charged with reviewing all of these expenses, and this program is going up to $1 billion next year. He pointed out that the Federal Department of Education administers around that much money, and they have hundreds of people kind of in charge of that situation. So, and Superintendent Tom Horn has told me in the past that, you know, we do need more people, that this program has not seen additional staffing since it exploded from 11,000 or so students to we're approaching 90,000 now following universal expansion.
Well, so why didn't the legislature and governor spend a little money to hire some more people to do this?
That's a good question. I actually was covering this late last year heading into this legislative session, and I heard from both Republicans and Democrats who thought that might be a good idea. Republican Matt Gress had told me he was going to work on securing that funding. Attorney General Chris Mays, who has prosecuted some of the fraud here, was like, she's like, I would like to see additional reforms, but at the very least, yeah, I guess more funding for people to catch this on the front end would be better than me catching it after the fraud has occurred. So one thing the governor told me is that she was fighting for additional safeguards and that her spokesman said that basically absence of those safeguards, they don't think additional bureaucrats are going to make much of a difference. I will say that the failed Republican budget did include about $2 million for an additional 12 staffers. That didn't make it into the final version of the budget that was negotiated by Hobbs and Senate Republicans.
So it sounds like the governor does not consider additional staff to be safeguards.
No, that's the impression I got from their statement. They're basically like the House Republicans blocked these additional reforms that we wanted attached to the additional staffing. Basically, they wanted to see new rules on the program that this staff would be charged with enforcing, not the existing rules, which is essentially these staffers are combing through these all the expenditures over $2,000, I should say, and making sure that they align with the program and aren't, you know, something extravagant like some of the things that Tom Horn has pointed out in the past, a Rolex watch or a $25,000 golf simulator, things like that.
So let's talk about that $2,000 figure, because that seems significant because earlier Tom Horn had said anything under $2,000, they're just going to let through and they'll investigate it basically when they can, right? And if they decide they need to get the money back, they'll just get it back.
Yeah, and that's all tied to this staffing issue. Last year, if you remember, we've talked about it, there was a months-long backlog. So every time a parent in the voucher program wants to buy something, they're essentially purchasing it on their own and then asking for a reimbursement from their account. And then these staff members go through and approve those reimbursements or don't approve them. There's a months-long backlog because there's just so many transactions going on and so few people looking at them. And so Superintendent Horn said he put this system into place where basically we're going to let those smaller amounts under $2,000 just go through so that we can clear this backlog. And that's basically been the status quo since that time.
But that's not seemingly what the law says they should be doing.
That's right. That's another issue. And again, all tied back to staffing. Last year, the state budget actually included some language requiring the department and specifically this audit, this division charged with auditing the voucher program, to work with the state auditor general's office to develop sort of a risk-based auditing process. Now, the department kind of says this 2000 situation is that risk-based auditing process. The only problem is the auditor general says we still haven't met with them. We've tried to meet with them, and we have not met with them yet to go over these processes, to consult as the law requires, to determine whether this is actually a good system that they're using. And again, Ward, the director of the voucher program, says, you know, we're too busy. Like, we were developing a handbook for parents, and we just don't have the staff available to also meet with you while we're doing these other things. Now, he said they've cleared that handbook issue, and so now they're willing to meet. But yeah, so far those meetings had not occurred, at least as of this meeting that was earlier this week.
So, Wayne, let's talk about the idea of flagging purchases in the first place, because this has been kind of a controversy, right? Especially politically leading up to next year's superintendent of public instruction race. The Freedom Caucus has endorsed State Treasurer Kimberly Yee, and their argument is nothing should be flagged, basically, right? Or most things should not be flagged, should be allowed to go through. There should be fewer restrictions. Tom Horn is saying some things should be allowed to go through, or most things should be allowed to go through, but there should be some things that are not allowed to go through. So how does all of that play into this issue with the fact that the department says it really maybe can't do as thorough a job as people would like?
That's right. Superintendent Horn, obviously a big fan of the voucher program, has like been an advocate for this type of system for a very, very long time. But Republicans, I guess to his right, maybe, have argued that he's not. And as you said, are backing Treasurer Yee. They're saying that the law doesn't specifically state that the superintendent has the power to deny certain purchases. And Horn, on the other hand, says, yeah, but there are purchases that are kind of outlined that this is what the program is for. So if someone's purchasing something that really has no defensible explanation as to why it's related to education, like that Rolex watch or something, that the department should, to keep the viability of the program, say, no, you can't use the money for that. You know, this is supposed to be for education. So all that's to say is that this idea of adding more staff, it's not just opposed by the governor's office who wants additional reforms. It's also opposed by some of the more further right members of the legislature who say that what Horn's doing now is too aggressive and they don't want to see any more kind of, I guess, what they view as kind of infringements on educational freedom for these parents.
Safe to say that this will continue to be an issue both policy-wise and political-wise for the near future?
100%. I imagine it's going to be an issue in the governor's race coming up as, you know, whoever the Republican candidate ends up being tries to paint Governor Katie Hobbs as someone who wants to repeal the program entirely, which she does, or not entirely, I should say, the universal expansion entirely.
Yeah.
And then vice versa, she's going to try and paint the Republicans as someone who just wants to let people spend this money on whatever with no guardrails in any way. And then the superintendent's race, as we mentioned, it's going to be big at play in the Republican primary there. And then all the legislative races as well. This voucher system, especially since universal expansion, has played into basically every Arizona political race, legislature on up.
Indeed. All right. That is Wayne Schutzke from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Wayne, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, earlier this year, we profiled a pair of folk singers who used their recent set at the Kennedy Center to protest the Trump administration's anti-trans policies. That would have been a noteworthy moment under any circumstances, but it was particularly remarkable because President Trump, of course, seized control of programming at the Kennedy Center earlier this year, and he did that with the explicit goal, he said, of expunging art he refers to as, quote, woke from the center's programming. Concerns about creative censorship have rippled out all over the country under President Trump, including right here in the Valley. Robert Pala covered this trend recently for Phoenix Magazine, and he joins me now. Robert, good morning.
Hey, Sam.
So, Robert, let's start by talking about some of these local examples. In your piece, you profile the former chief curator of the Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum. Tell us why she's the former curator.
Well, So Tiffany Farrell, I can't say enough about Tiffany Farrell because she is that rare exception. She's somebody who stood up to censorship. And so she's the former curator because they tied a can to her tail. She was asked to remove art from some of the shows that she curated. She was the chief curator there, as you said. And she said, no, that is not my job. My job is not to censor art. My job is to bring art to the public. I'm the curator.
Hmm. And what was their reaction to that?
Well, after she was gone, their reaction was exactly what you would anticipate, which is in one case, they blamed her staff. They canceled a show, which I think they later put back on the schedule, and they issued a statement. I think this was maybe 2 years ago, saying, We canceled that show. We postponed that show because the staff was not ready. Well, the staff was ready.
Right.
But there was work in the show that city managers, because this is a city-run museum, didn't like. They didn't like the commentary behind the pieces that were being shown.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there was a similar situation recently at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art with a touring exhibition that was originally called Transfeminisms, I believe.
Yeah.
But it did not open under that title.
No. No, it didn't. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is it took place in plain sight. This was censorship that you could see and track if you were, as we are, if you were a journalist who was receiving catalog copy and press releases. We got a press release, I don't know, late last year that said, hey, we're bringing that Transfeminisms show from London, and it's going to be at Smoka next year. Yay. And then a few months later, it turns up in the catalog as something called something else, and the show was very different.
Yeah.
The new title of the show was There Are Other Skies. Please note that this does not have that nasty prefix of trans.
Right,
in it.
Right.
And, you know, the show went from being about, in London, it was about women, queer, and trans people. But in Scottsdale, the same show was suddenly about urgent, pressing, and ongoing topics faced by female-identifying people worldwide. Hmm. So it's the same show, but it's being presented differently. It's
right.
The same show, but they took work out of the show.
Right. Well, that kind of parsing in the language that you were just referring to and in the Mesa example, the blaming it on the staff, this is one of the things you point out in the piece, is that the administrators at these institutions would, of course, insist that they're against censorship. What is their explanation for making these changes?
Their explanation is a lot of corporate speak and a lot of denial. No, you got it wrong. That's not what we're—I mean, I report this in the piece that they're doing their jobs, which is to say, yeah, no, we didn't do that. We don't agree with censorship. It's wrong and bad and awful. And then you say, yeah, but look, there's four pieces missing from the show, and you retitled it, and the curators of the show— of the exhibition are saying to me and to everyone else, our show was censored.
Right. Well, and of course, as you pointed out, these are shows where, in the case of Transfeminisms, or the exhibition formerly known as Transfeminisms, a release went out indicating that there was a different title. And so it's a known thing. It's a fair question to ask why the title would be changed.
Right. And I did ask the director of Smoka, and he said, you know, the London reviews of this exhibition suggested that maybe the title was more controversial than it needed to be. So this is, to answer your earlier question, this is the kind of explanation that one gets when you hold their feet to the fire, when you say to the director of a museum, why did you fire your chief curator, or why did you take work out of a show, or why did you try to get her to take work out of a show? They're not going to say, oh, well, because we were afraid of losing funding. No one's going to do that.
Well, we have just about a minute left here, Robert, and I'm curious, you know, in addition to writing about this and in addition to being an artist yourself, you have also worked as a curator. You have had these sorts of conversations with the folks who are on the administrative side of these institutions.
Mm.
What have those experiences suggested to you about why this happens?
I think sometimes it comes down to being a bad match. It's just bad practice, lousy management. You know, you want to hire someone to run your museum who can keep an eye on the bottom line, but you don't want that person messing with the exhibition itself, deciding what goes in, because they're afraid of losing the funding that will keep the bottom line where it needs to be. My experience was that I was the guest curator at the Herberger Art Center for a year. And I did what curators do, which is at the beginning of the year, beginning of the season, I submitted my four shows to this woman who ran the gallery and who, frankly, should not have been running the gallery because she had no insight into art. And she did not look at my submissions until right before the fourth show opened, at which point she said, Yeah, this photograph by the artist Michael Thomas Ford is not appropriate, so you need to take that one out. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. And she canceled the show.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but this is obviously an ongoing situation.
It is, yeah.
Robert Pala wrote about this for Phoenix Magazine. Robert, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning, it's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. For the better part of a decade, we have been reckoning with the place that social media and online spaces should have in our lives. Are they tools to engage with only when necessary, or digital communities to exist and form relationships and have discussions? As more and more young people and children live much of their lives online, we're starting to see the negative impacts of attention span and mental health. And at the same time, colleges and universities are making deep cuts to humanities programs. My next guest says that is a missed opportunity to counteract the negative psychological impacts of digital culture. Emily Anhalt is a classic literature professor at Sarah Lawrence College, and I spoke with her recently about this article she wrote on the subject for The American Scholar. Anhalt's piece is called The Art of Coping, which she says is exactly what great literature can help students do.
I find this situation extremely tragic, but also ironic, because we are systematically depriving students of tools that have been developed over centuries.
Well, this was one of the things that was so thrilling to me to read in the article that you wrote about this, was this idea that one of the values in engaging with the humanities and classic texts and stories in particular is that by and large, these are narratives about human beings coping with the unfairness of life.
Yes, exactly. And these are the works that have stood the test of time.
Right.
And I don't just mean classical works. I think the art and literature and historiography of all peoples and places has the value of having lasted, having endured, because it has a lot to say about the human condition.
Well, so as an example, in your piece about this, you write in particular about the stories of Homer. You go all the way back to the Greeks. Can you give us an example of one of the stories that illustrates this for you?
Perhaps the most obvious one, and because it's in the zeitgeist right now, that is the stories about Odysseus. And there are new movies coming out about Odysseus. And Odysseus is a figure who exemplifies the vicissitudes of fortune. He starts out as a very beloved king, very powerful in his own community. He's a conqueror. Then he is a shipwrecked sailor and he's totally destitute. He arrives home as a beggar and he ultimately becomes a king once again. So he exemplifies how you deal with these ups and downs in human life. And for one thing, he never gives up. And for another, he actually kind of enjoys the challenge. And I think one of the things my students need to experience is the delights of persistence.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things that you write about is this idea that in many of these ancient stories, particularly in the Greek literature, when characters make it to a kind of paradise, a place that is ostensibly free from torment, it's not exactly gratifying.
Odysseus experiences this idyllic paradise on the island of Calypso, which is a magical place. He's hosted by a goddess who's exquisitely beautiful. He has every creature comfort. He's in a beautiful setting, beachside setting, and he's miserable because he wants to go home.
Right.
And when Calypso offers him immortality, he turns it down. Part of his reason for leaving is that if he stayed in paradise, no one would ever know about him. Mm. And for the Greeks, the thing that you strive for is for everyone to remember your exploits ever after, because they didn't think of the afterlife as anything desirable at all. Mm-hmm. And again, Odysseus is the example of that. He turns down an offer to stay there forever. It's sort of a fairy tale paradise. And he says, no, thanks.
Yeah.
And I liken it in the article to people spending a lot of time in virtual spaces.
Yes. Yes.
With escapist television and film.
Much of which, right, is designed to be free of torment, to reduce any kind of friction between
the consumer of that media and opinions, attitudes, ideas that they might disagree with.
Yes, exactly. And just like the places that Odysseus visits, those virtual spaces are designed to seduce you, to lure you in. But our time is such a valuable commodity that we have. So any time we spend doing that is time taken away from other things that might actually give us more emotional and psychological rewards.
And there is such an interesting parallel, I think, between the supernatural elements that somebody like Odysseus encounters and the algorithms that power these online spaces,
yes,
which are somewhat supernatural in nature, not in the sense that, you know, they're actually ghostly or something like that, but precious few people can actually explain to you how they work.
Yeah, even the designers. And the thing about the algorithms is they bring us ourselves. They bring us what right. we are interested in, what we believe. Whereas reading a work of literature can take you somewhere entirely new. I find for my students that reading these kinds of works takes them outside of themselves
right.
and gives them something else to think about beside their own anxieties. And at the same time, these works enable students to realize that their own struggles are not unique, but they are in fact part of the human condition.
Yeah. And have been going back to antiquity.
Exactly.
This conversation is making me think about a post I saw on social media recently. You may have seen the same one, and it's of a piece with many others. But somebody who is a big AI evangelist put up something basically saying, you know, I don't know why people are so against ChatGPT. You could either read a book a month or have ChatGPT teach you the big takeaways from 100 books a week. And that makes me think about the way that you write about the role of AI in your classroom.
Yeah, it's a hard sell, but I tell my students AI can tell you what other people have thought about these works, but it can't tell you what you think about mm-hmm. these works. And the point is in the process. It's what you discover by encountering them. I give the analogy that using AI, whether it's for reading these texts or for helping write student papers about them, would be like purchasing a gym membership and then having someone else use it for you and thinking that you'll get fit that way.
That's I have often wished that I could find somebody to use my gym membership for me after I've purchased it.
Yes, we all do, but it doesn't really help us that much.
Yes. Well, it seems like the case that you're trying to make to your students here is I understand why it may seem like a way of addressing this baseline anxiety that you feel to take these shortcuts, but that in taking these shortcuts, you're actually deepening the problem that's causing you the anxiety in the first place.
That's exactly right. And when they're on social media or in their digital engagement, they can never escape their anxieties. Mm-hmm. Part of their stress and anxiety is that social media has trained them to think in very absolutist terms, like the like and don't like are your options on social media.
Right.
But reality is much more complicated than that. So when they encounter complexity in real life, they get very frustrated. What I found in my class is that students can discuss really hot button issues much more objectively because they're not talking about themselves and their own lives. They're talking about representative figures, fictional characters or real historical figures.
Well, Emily Ann Holtz is a professor of classic literature at Sarah Lawrence College and wrote this really thought-provoking piece called The Art of Coping. Emily, thank you so much for this conversation.
Sam, it was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you today.
Thank you, as always, for listening to the show. We hope it helps you navigate your own vicissitudes of fortune on this Thursday. We will be right back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Hope you will join us again. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.